I'm out to sing songs. It'll prove to you that this is your world. And that if it's hit you pretty hard and knocked you down for a dozen loops, no matter how hard it's run you down and rolled over you, no matter what color, what size you are, how you're built, I am out to sing the songs that'll make you take pride in yourself.
I'm Lori Sonnenfeld.
And I'm Don Jacobson.
Together we bring you Moving On, Fridays from 12 noon to 1:30.
We feature both traditional and contemporary folk music.
We love to present live in-studio concerts from local and national musicians.
Tune in and you'll hear music that is socially progressive, moving, and heartfelt.
Music heard only on the left-hand edge of the dial and only on KABU.
Every Friday, noon to 1:30.
We who believe in freedom cannot
I'm out to sing songs. It'll prove to you that this is your world. And that if it's hit you pretty hard and knocked you down for a dozen loops, no matter...
It's 11 o'clock and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
Thanks for tuning in to Intersections Radio. Today's episode continues celebrating the 25th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act, this time with a historical perspective. My guests include disability studies scholar Leonard Davis, disability rights lawyer Haben Girma, and A Tale of Medical School Survival by deaf Pakistani-American Shazia Siddiqui. I'm Sarika Mehta, and this is Intersections Radio. Leonard Davis is a disability studies scholar at the University of Illinois at Chicago. And just in time for the 25th anniversary of the ADA, he published his latest book, Enabling Acts, the hidden story of how the Americans with Disabilities Act gave the largest U.S. minority its rights. We met on Skype, and he taught me the real lesson in how a bill becomes a law. Our conversation began with the Section 504 of the Rehabilitative Act of 1973, where activism and legislation came together and essentially became the Americans with Disabilities Act.
Okay, so in the Rehabilitation Act of 1973, which is really basically designed to be a rehab act, at the time the president was Richard Nixon. And so the bill was passed in Congress and the Senate, and Nixon vetoed it. And then it was passed again. Then they tried to pass it again, and Nixon vetoed it again the second time because he didn't want the independent living funds in there. However, there was in the act something that nobody really noticed at the time. I mean, you know, with all the debate about the independent living funds, no one noticed that there was this little tiny section called 504. And Section 504, you know, hidden within this bill was just a tweet length Section 504, which nobody really noticed. And if you go back and look at the debates in Congress and so on, it's not mentioned at all. There's no legislative history on it. But it basically says that no otherwise qualified person could be denied their civil rights. So once the bill was passed, I don't know who noticed it or didn't notice it. But suddenly people realized that 504 was there. And like with any bill, there had to be regulations. So there was a long period of writing the regulations for Section 504. And it took such a long time. I think it took 7 years before the regulations were signed. And during that time, Nixon, as you know, left office. And then Carter came in. And there was kind of a feeling among people with disabilities that, yeah, with Carter, it would happen quickly. And it didn't happen particularly quickly. His Secretary of Health, HEW, Health, Education, and Welfare, Califano, just seemed to be sitting on it for a long time. And it was during this period, this is really when I think all of the disability groups banded together and we really get a sense that, yeah, there's this cross-country, cross-disability movement that begins. And so around the country in various places, there were a lot of protests, and culminating in the San Francisco protest, in which 100 people occupied the HEW building for, I think it's 28 or 29 days. It was the longest occupation of a federal building in U.S. history. And finally, Califano was forced to sign the regulations, and they went into effect. I think that you can date the concept of disability activism and a disability, cross-disability movement to that point. I mean, there were cross-disability organizations, but that's sort of like the flashpoint.
That is pretty incredible that something so short and small and seemingly, you know, invisible in this massive bill is what was the foundation for such a huge movement.
I know, it is. It's whimsical in a certain kind of way. And by the way, there's speculation about who put that in there, but there's no one has ever stepped forward and said, like, I did it. Yeah. I mean, we have a name of somebody, but that, as far as I know, that person, I was not able to locate that person. And it was probably an intern who was something like 20 years old and working. But yeah, it's you would think it that person should be enshrined in the Disability Hall of Fame. But really, that's one of the stories. One of the things that interests me in this book that I wrote, Enabling Acts, is just the whimsical nature of the way that politics happen. You know, had that intern not put this in, there might not have been a pan-disability movement at exactly that time in that way.
These are such great stories that, I mean, with as much work I've been doing in this field, I had no idea. These are great stories. Did you have any other favorite stories from while you were writing this book or other adventures that came up along the way?
Because most people tell the story from the point of view of disability activism, but I was able to get memos and talk to people who are in the White House, and that gives us a whole other view of it. So anyway, the story that interests me is how this bill got going in the first place. What happened was that there were a group of people from Berkeley, part of the whole Berkeley Independent Living movement. You could say Berkeley activists, Berkeley hippies, who were part of this group called DREDIF, which was a spinoff from the Center for Independent Living. And DREDIF is the education and legal defense branch. And there was a woman named Pat Wright and another woman named Arlene Mayerson, a guy named Bob Funk, who just looked at each other one day in the middle of a meeting and said, let's go to Washington. I mean, literally like that. And the reason they went was because, you know, Reagan was in power at that point, and Reagan's whole thing was deregulation. So there was a lot of legitimate fear that you know, services and things that had been hard won under 504 were going to be rolled back. The first person whose floor they crashed on was a guy named Evan Kemp. And Evan Kemp came from a family of Democrats who were well known. He used a wheelchair. He went to law school and he graduated at the top of his class and couldn't get a job. And so he began to be aware of the fact that there was this tremendous discrimination against people with disabilities, which I suppose he'd known all along. He approached Ralph Nader and he started a Ralph Nader Raider office in Washington on DuPont Circle. He had like a tiny two rooms and a big and a couple of desks, and he basically gave his office to the DREDIF people and let them sleep on his floor. Turns out that Evan Kemp was an extremely good bridge player. He had a Thursday night kind of Washington bridge game going, where a lot of, you know, some people came, and one of the people who came regularly was this guy named C. Boyden Gray. And he ended up being the legal counsel for Vice President George Bush, who at that time. So Kemp is playing every Thursday night with Boyden Gray. But in the course of that, he's also learning a lot about disability, because Kemp is telling him about his experiences. And so Pat Wright, who's friends with Kemp now, sleeping on his floor, starts talking to Boyden Gray. I mean, so this is like a weird connection, because Boyden Gray is a super neoconservative. So you got these like Berkeley hippies now with a direct connection to the interior of the White House through Boyden Gray. Well, when Bush gets elected president, Boyden Gray becomes the legal counsel. He is now one of the most powerful men in the United States, and he is passing information, talking to, and coordinating things with people like Pat Wright. So that's kind of fascinating, because people say like, oh, the Capitol crawl was really important. And I almost think like that bridge game was almost more important. I mean, had that bridge game not been going on, it's not clear that the disability activists would have ever been able to get any connections inside the White House. And by the way, Evan Kemp then transferred over and started working inside the White House as a result of that.
That is a really good story. And bridge game and couch surfing, like the old school Airbnb situation. You were talking about these hidden stories, and something that I was curious about in this 25th anniversary, I've been seeing a lot of social media posts and comments that the ADA and the movement kind of looked like a white movement, that there wasn't much representation from people of color with disabilities. Do you have any thoughts or comments about that?
Well, I think that's true. I mean, I know that during the Section 504 occupation in San Francisco that the Black Panthers were involved, or at least one or two were. But, you know, a lot of these people that I detail come from wealthy families, you know, and are white elite people. I think that that provided a kind of cover for what is, in essence, a kind of radical piece of legislation. You know, I mean, Justin Dart is a good example of that. I mean, he was the heir to Walgreens, the Walgreens fortune. So I think you needed to have this group of white, privileged, elite people to get this bill through Congress. I mean, I think that's true. However, I mean, one of the groups that was very important was Conference on Civil Rights that was headed by Ralph Neese. Ralph Neese is not a person of color, but the organization itself was the largest group of people of color and of various ethnicities in the country. It's a coordinating committee for every single group like NAACP, CORE. I mean, you go down the line, I think there were 125 organizations. And that group, under the leadership of Neese, but still, that group really made it possible to turn the legislation into something about civil rights. But on the other hand, there is an interesting somewhat of a conflict between African Americans and people with disabilities, that there's a tension there that was there. And let me just give you a couple of examples. One is that the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which we all know, was basically an act about people of color, ethnicities, and so on. I think a couple of years later, women were added to that legislation. Hubert Humphrey decided that he wanted to add disability to that legislation, to the 1964 Civil Rights Act. And there was a huge pushback from African Americans who did not want that. And they didn't want it because, A, they didn't want the bill watered down as they saw it with like a lot of other groups, but also that they legitimately were worried that if the bill came back to the Senate, that there could be a lot of damaging amendments, and they didn't want to do that. So there wasn't a strong alliance, I think, until the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights came along. So by the time you get to the late 1980s, there isn't this opposition anymore. And, you know, I mean, if you look at photographs, there are photographs from the marches, you see mainly white faces, but you do see black people as well.
Is there anything else, any other topics we haven't talked about?
I mean, I really got to know better the role of the disability activist community, as well as a lot of people who are behind the scenes really organizing this, because this bill would have never happened had there not been tremendous coordination through all the states and through, you know, getting people with disabilities to contact their congresspeople and senators. I mean, I think that is really important, and I think everybody should, you know, read about it and know about it. This 25th anniversary is important. There's a long way to go. There's a lot more to do. But, you know, disability has become part of the U.S. in a way that it wasn't before. And we take so many things for granted now that we're part of this act. Wheelchair lifts on buses, curb cuts, captioning on TV, relays for deaf people. I mean, these are things that are just part of the environment that we look at and just think we're always there. But I think one of the other messages here is that I asked almost all the politicians that I spoke to, Bob Dole, Orrin Hatch, Tom Harkin, all of the heavy hitters, and I said, do you think this bill could pass today? And every one of them said no.
Why did they feel that way?
Because this is bipartisan legislation. And it also really, you know, as I describe in the book, you had to have agreement between groups that normally don't agree with each other. I mean, you had to have business say that they were willing to do this. It's going to cost them money. It's going to inconvenience them to some degree. And you had people who are fighting for disability rights. Those are, you know, mostly Democrats on the left. You know, the left and right had to come up with a compromise in bipartisanship. That bipartisanship doesn't exist anymore today. And one example of that is the UN Treaty on Disabilities, which has been signed and ratified by every country in the United States, except for the U.S. We signed it, but we won't ratify it. And we won't ratify it because the left and right can't agree. The right thinks that this is going to be a UN treaty is going to impinge on the right of the U.S. government to have its own autonomy, which is completely not true. And Tea Party homeschoolers are saying, we don't want people telling us how to, you know, teach our disabled children. So that kind of unanimity is over. I mean, Bob Dole, who was a big supporter of the ADA, now is in his 90s and is very frail, came on the floor of the Senate last year and said, please pass this bill, and nobody would.
Yeah, I remember that, and that's a good point. It's sad to think we're in that current state of affairs.
Yep.
Leonard Davis, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me for Intersections Radio.
Well, my pleasure, and thanks. It was a good conversation.
That was Leonard Davis, author of Enabling Acts, the hidden story of how the Americans with Disabilities Act gave the largest U.S. minority its rights. This was an abbreviated interview, and you can listen to the extended version at intersectionsradio.wordpress.com. I'm Sarika Mehta, and this is Intersections Radio. Haben Girma is a deaf-blind lawyer and Skadden Fellow with Disability Rights Advocates in Berkeley. She was born to Eritrean-Ethiopian parents who moved to the U.S. so their children could have a better education. Haben's debut activist movement started right here in Portland at Lewis and Clark College, where she rallied to have access to the cafeteria menu. This experience inspired her to pursue Harvard Law School. Haben was prominently featured at the White House celebrations of the 25th anniversary of the ADA. After returning home, we chatted by phone and real-time Braille captioning. Well, again, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me.
Absolutely. I know I have a unique story, and I would love to help the community as much as possible. And if sharing that story is helpful, then it's my honor to be able to do that.
And so, speaking of the 25th anniversary, you were recently invited to give the opening remarks at the White House celebration. And this included not only introducing the president and vice president, but there's a video of President Obama communicating with you on this real-time Braille captioning service and giving you a hug at the end. So tell us about this incredible experience.
It took me a long time to feel really comfortable communicating and connecting with people in a manner that's not mainstream, that's very different from most people. And seeing the President of the United States and his staff treat people, engage and connect with people with dignity and respect means a lot for our country, and it does mean that we've come a long way. There's still more to be done. There's still a lot of unequal access to opportunities. There are a lot of deafblind individuals who don't have the resources to have the technology I have. And that needs to change. But I think my recent interactions with President Obama and being able to use my keyboard and Braille display to connect and have a conversation really highlights how technology and positive attitudes towards disability and a willingness to use that technology can empower people with disabilities.
And none of it seemed awkward, or actually everything seemed very seamless and everybody was very excited. And
it took a lot of work to get to that point. And all the opportunities I've had have been a result of advocates working for years to pass the ADA in the first place and to make it real and make it actually open doors and give people with disabilities opportunities. So I'm really, really honored to be able to showcase how the ADA can make that promise of equality real.
So I wanted to look a little bit at your life story as far as the intersection of race and ethnicity and disability as a deaf, blind, Eritrean, Ethiopian American woman. Did you ever struggle to reconcile a balance of cultures or feeling included in any of these communities?
So I belong to many, many, many different communities, and I consider that a blessing. There are definitely individuals in each community that make it difficult to be part of that community, but there are also individuals in each community that make me very grateful to be part of that community. So So I also recognize that within the Eritrean community, there's lots of diversity. And within the deaf community, there's lots of diversity. So I try not to let stereotypes or individuals with negative perceptions affect my participation in cultural communities, whether it's based on race or ethnicity, or whether it's based on disability.
The people who are involved in disability services or providing accommodations, did you ever feel that they had an appropriate cultural sensitivity to your experiences?
That's an interesting question. I think most people who provided disability services when I was growing up were white, a lot of white women. I don't think that raised any issues. I didn't feel like they were insensitive. Part of that may be that I grew up in the Bay Area, where people are more aware of diversity and cultural backgrounds. And I remember many of my teachers for the visually impaired being very interested in my Eritrean heritage and the stories and food of my family. So maybe I was just lucky to have people who were very sensitive to cultural issues.
This raises another concern or question that I had regarding the Americans with Disabilities Act of 1990. As you know, I've seen some frustrations that this is seen as a mostly white movement, and that people of color who were involved maybe are not getting quite the recognition. Do you have any thoughts about this?
That raises really important questions of why people of color in the disability movement are not receiving recognition. It sort of highlights issues of unequal access to resources and unequal access to opportunities. And what can we do to change that? What can we make sure that everyone has access to opportunities and that people of color in the disability movement get recognition, just like members of the disability community who are not people of color?
Haben Gurmat, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me and for joining me on Intersections Radio.
Thank you for letting me share my story and for being patient in organizing all of this.
That was Haben Gurmat, Scott and Fellow with Disability Rights Advocates in Berkeley. This was also an abbreviated interview, and you can catch the extended version online at intersectionsradio.wordpress.com. I'm Sarika Mehta, and this is Intersections Radio. Finally, I'm thrilled to feature another story from the collection of deaf South Asian Americans with the story by Shazia Siddiqui. She originally told her story in American Sign Language, and Kirti Hasija Kaufman provided voiceover. Shazia is a deaf Pakistani American woman from Southern California who survived medical school in the Caribbean without accommodations.
At the time, I was a California resident, so I was waitlisted for some medical schools. I grew tired of waiting. I felt like I was getting old, and a lot of my friends were going to Caribbean for school, to St. George's University. And that's when all the frustrations began. I knew it was an international school. I had to ask vocational rehab to help me request real-time captioning at my school, and the request had been denied. And it's an international school, so I had to accept this. I tried to manage in other ways, like asking friends for notes. Some classmates would type out the lectures, and I would copy their notes. I also had a tutor, and that was helpful. And luckily, it's funny, I always find people willing to help me out. There were two fluent signers. One was a Jehovah's Witness, and the other was a Mormon. They were on their missionary year working with deaf people, so they knew American Sign Language very well. I asked for their help, and I used my loans to pay them to help me out with my clinicals, like working with patients. And they accepted. I had to foot the bill myself, and they would come with me for clinical work. It's an international school, so I had to find people, ask if they'll help, and pay for it myself. For my rotations, I went to hospitals in New York and London. My program started, and then my father was stricken with a serious heart condition. He needed a transplant, and we had to wait for one. We were all in a state of shock, so I had to put on school on hold for a while. After some time, I was finally able to go back to school, back to my hospital rotations. Everything was going fine. I had good peers and classmates who would share information, and we'd help each other out. And that helped me in my rotation since I didn't have any interpreters. And I would try to read lips. If I didn't understand the doctor, I would note it and ask again later. It worked out. So now we have new technology, like the iPad. So I realize now that everything can be achieved through technology. In retrospect, it would have been nice if I could have had remote captions for my classes. Maybe the iPad could have captioned my classes simultaneously while the teacher lectured. That way I could see the text and not miss anything. Ideally, best case scenario, I would have an interpreter live in person for my classes. For my lab classes, I preferred an interpreter. Like if there's a cadaver, I have to look at the cadaver, then the interpreter, and then back to the cadaver and back and forth. Yeah, lab classes are a challenge. You just have to be proactive all the time. You have to go one step further to educate people. That's been the story of my life. You always have to take extra measure to teach people all the time. That's just life. You have to be proactive. Sure, there were many frustrating times. I used to complain to my roommate and to my partner. There were a lot of frustrating times. But I mean, I had support from my families and friends. I just made it through. I made it through.
Thanks for listening to Intersections Radio. Thank you to all of my guests, Leonard Davis, Haben Girma, and Shazia Siddiqui. Special thanks to Kirti Hasija Kaufman for lending your voice. And thank you to our engineer, Liz Rogers. The music you hear is by Rupa and the April Fishes. You can find archives and extended interviews at intersectionsradio.wordpress.com. Like us on facebook.com/intersectionsradio. And catch the show first Fridays at 11 a.m. right here on KBOO. I'm Sarika Mehta. Thanks for listening.
I got everything I need. Tell me, there ain't nothing they can sell that'll make me take my mind off what I'm doing here. Because I'm on my way, yes, I'm on my way now. Nobody, nobody said it's gonna be easy. Cause the road is long, it's gonna be longer still. And when I lose my way, I just drop to my knees. I put my hands to the ground now, and I'll build. My hands to the ground, I feel the earth breathe, and I'm built, yeah. Got everything I need.
And this is KBOO Portland. It's 11:30 a.m. Coming up on the Radio Zine, we speak with members of the Chilean reggae band Aflora Reggae about the state of the educational system in Chile, the impact of the neoliberal economy and exploitation of natural resources, and the intention of their music to promote unity in the world. And thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support, and to all of you for listening to KBOO. Those of you who have not yet become members of the KBOO Foundation can remedy that oversight at kboo.fm. Just click where it says Donate Today. Stay tuned for the Radio Zine.